I asked my father if he knew where he was, and he said, kind of. You were in the hospital. Your hip surgery went well, but there is a virus, and you have been found to have it. You are contagious. No one can get near you. It's happening all over the world. You caught it in your assisted living facility. The chef had it. His blue eyes had a light that appeared to race from the back of his brain to the front. The brightness of them seemed to direct itself with sudden power into the screen, then straight through and past me. Lori Moore, in her story, FaceTime, in The New Yorker, September 28, 2020. Welcome to Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. In her New Yorker short story, Lori Moore tells the story of a woman communicating with her father on FaceTime. He is dying from the virus. She can't comfort him with her touch or embrace him with the subtle tenderness of her voice. FaceTime. The screen between them is a barrier that robs the moment of any intimacy, of any feeling of his presence. In fact, she finds these FaceTime calls stressful and takes out her feeling of frustration on the nursing staff. The story continues. Yes, the nurse said. I'll send you some pictures of him sleeping, she added, and began tapping the iPad. Then she looked up. Good night, she said brightly, performing the role of saintly nurse, her head filling the screen as she moved to shut it off. Surely her loving kindness would vanish as soon as the iPad went dark, and her demeanor would reveal an eagerness to be rid of this COVIDic old guy with his bed sore and immobile hip, his catheter and oxygen tubing. The narrator here, in her frustration, is not a woman comforting her father. She is reduced to being a witness to suffering. We know that this pandemic is pervasive. What it's doing to us relative to the economy, its effect on us socially, and certainly with over 7 million infected and more than 200,000 dead, what it's doing to us physically, as it pervades every facet of our lives, what is its impact on us psychologically? How has it challenged our mental health as individuals and as a society? My guest today is Dr. Carl Mayer, professor of psychology at Salisbury University. His specialty is behavioral medicine. Dr. Mayer, welcome to Delmarva Today.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Carl, there has been a bit of research on stress and the mental health impacts of COVID-19 on the general population, on individuals, and particularly on frontline essential workers. Can you give us an overview of some of that research?
Sure. And to back up, there's really a general concern that we're facing a mental health pandemic that's not well seen by most people. And despite a lot of data coming in really on a daily basis, there really are no solid conclusions. So we see the tip of the iceberg, so to speak, but we're trying to size up the scope of the issues. And I think your lead-in gets right to the personal level of COVID patients, families, and healthcare providers, really. And for victims and families, it's mostly anecdotal accounts that we have, but you know, clearly those with significant illness and their families have had pretty terrifying experiences, especially early on when so little was known about the virus and how it transpires. And so when you think about that, and also social isolation, you know, that's something that can be difficult for anyone. But when somebody's suddenly ill with a disease that could kill them, and that disease could, you know, be short or drawn out, and the person can't be with their loved ones, that's a strain for them, obviously, that's less than typical. And the family members, they can't be with that loved one. And if they pass away, well, that doesn't really allow for the natural grieving process to occur. So I would expect that there'd be a lot of complicated grief issues in the months and perhaps even years to come. On the other side, from the patients are the frontline workers. And of course, there are concerns for those folks as well. But we don't have good data yet. There's some data coming in from China and other areas that were hit first that indicate a very high level of post-traumatic stress symptoms. But some of that data is also showing pretty high rates of what we call vicarious traumatization among, you know, medical staff and other personnel in the medical centers who are indirectly exposed, who aren't really taking direct care of the patients, and even in the general population. So the effects we see really may be quite mixed across these different groups, but certainly extend beyond the frontline workers, so to speak. Now, I will add, if I may, within the U.S., we do have some data on essential workers. So this is by self-report, and so that may include medical frontline workers as well as non-medical personnel. You know, people who are doing our, you know, food service and deliveries and all those essential workers who are suddenly becoming much more noticed in society. The data is showing that those essential workers are reporting many more trauma symptoms than non-essential workers. And that's, of course, concerning. But also concerning is a lot more new substance use in those populations of essential workers, and 2 to 3 times the rate of serious thoughts of suicide compared to non-essential workers. So we're considering a pretty significant problem here with that.
In terms of the nature of the problem, how is the problem manifesting itself? And I guess I'm looking for a little more detail on what happens to these workers. I mean, for an example, is their functional capacity reduced? You know, like fatigue, for instance, will reduce your functional capacity. Is their mental capacity, their alertness, reduced? What impact do these traumas have on their lives? And for essential workers, for instance, how does it affect their work?
Yeah, those are great questions. And without the data, I can speculate. There's probably a distinction between, you know, medical frontline workers and other essential workers out there in the community. And you think about medical workers, especially in, you know, trauma-related settings, nurses and physicians, those people go into that line of work and generally they're cut out for that and they're passionate about what they do and they can't see doing anything else. And so I think initially those individuals really rose to the occasion and went into harm's way. And to do that, you have to be psychologically adjusted for that and willing to take the consequences. And so in some way, my sense is that early on, those kind of healthcare providers probably were functioning pretty effectively, even though there was a high degree of stress and, you know, probably fear. They're rising to the occasion. But over time, of course, the situation can wear on you. And when you're constantly seeing people in front of you dying, maybe unexpectedly, despite your best efforts, that's going to really be a burden. Now, essential workers otherwise, that's a different situation altogether, because these are individuals who maybe have a job because, well, that's the job they can get and that's the job they depend on, yet they're called to be in service to the rest of us under circumstances that maybe they don't want to be facing. And so in a way, they never signed up for that, right? So the grocery workers, the delivery personnel, all those people who really have to be working, they can't afford not to work. but don't want to be exposed and maybe don't have the protections that maybe a medical center might be able to provide. So I think the resilience and the resources that these different groups have is quite different. And I think the data is going to still tell a story of that.
How about the general public, Carl? How have these traumas, do you feel anyway, how have these traumas impacted the general public?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. We're starting to get a little bit of data. For example, the CDC does track some mental health symptoms in the general population. And, you know, that's not a lot to go on right now, but one particular study is showing that 26% of one survey showed trauma-related symptoms that are related to COVID-19. And not having the disease, but just, you know, the stress about thinking about it, what we call intrusive thoughts, so repeatedly thinking about it more than you want to, difficulty sleeping and things like that. And that's a pretty significant number of people to be having those types of symptoms. Now, I want to be clear, that's not necessarily diagnosing people with post-traumatic stress disorder, right? But even having those symptoms, that seems like a pretty high percentage, even though we don't have data to compare necessarily within that sample. Now, in that same study by the CDC, 13% have started using or increased use of substances to cope with COVID-19 stress. And that's particularly telling, I think, because this isn't just about trends that we see nationally anyway, and in the state and locally about substance use increase. But this is specifically people reporting that they're beginning to use and increasing their use to deal with the stress of COVID-19. And from what I understand from some local substance treatment providers, the treatment's becoming much more complex and their clients are in crisis much more frequently. And it's a complicated situation for anyone, but certainly somebody who is, you know, struggling and trying to cope, and substances are a part of that. It really kind of complicates the issues. Now, I had mentioned before about thoughts of suicide in the general population. We're looking at, according to this one study, about 10% of people reporting serious thoughts of suicide in the past 30 days. Now, again, we don't have a lot of good comparison data, but in 2015, you know, it was about 4% of people thought about that in the past year. And this is 10% thinking about this in the past 30 days. So that's concerning in multiple levels. Now, I think what's most concerning is some of the data from the CDC showing it's really young adults who are affected more than any other age group in most areas of mental health. And that's substantially, they're doing substantially worse than other age groups.
In terms of the public, again, we have stages of grief that people go through in order to deal with the death of a loved one or a very close friend or other traumatic events, and those stages are fairly well defined. As a public, we've been dealing with this virus now, with the shutdown, with the kind of crash in the economy, at least on the local level, dealing with that as well. Do you get the sense that the public here is undergoing any kind of stages, psychological changes in reference to this virus and the isolation that we're experiencing now? What's behind my question here is really the fact that it seems as though as states like Florida open to everything again, there's kind of a denial of this virus that's worked its way at least through the governmental structure there. But do you see any sense of psychological impact in this way on the general public?
Well, there are definitely different ways of coping individually and as a nation, but the challenge is that everybody's kind of at a different place depending on their personal situation and what they've been going through. But the American Psychological Association has done every year a survey of the U.S. Looking at basically stress and what are the stress levels of people in the country. And what they found is that there is quite a bit of increase, okay, in terms of COVID-related stress this past year. And even though that's increased over the past few months, those levels of stress have been somewhat steady, which is, I guess, a good sign, maybe a sign of coping and grieving. And in fact, there's been a slight decrease in COVID-specific stress in the past month. And they're trying to track this every month. So we'll kind of see how that goes. But I think it's a complicated question because, you know, there's stress levels, but then there are other emotions as well. And in that same survey by the APA called Stress in America, if folks want to look at that, by July, even though stress levels have kind of stabilized a little bit, people are reporting greater uncertainty about the future of the country and also the political climate as sources of stress. And so when we think about healing, certainly we're going to need, you know, individual healing to the extent that people are affected specifically by their situation and maybe being sick with COVID or just the disruptions of COVID. But all that healing personally has to take place in the context of the society we live in. And so it's going to be important that we see healing as a nation and globally, really. But I mentioned about those sources of stress also because they're finding that even though, you know, slight decreases in stress levels related to COVID, particularly in the Northeast, those rates of stress are not uniform. We're seeing higher rates of stress in the rates in the areas where the rates are increasing. So areas not in the Northeast, in the South, Midwest, and everything like that, there are increases in stress levels. And nationally, they're reporting more frustration, emotions of fear, and even anger, not necessarily tied to any particular thing. So it's kind of a tumultuous time. So in some respects, stress levels maybe are tapering off, but they are kind of following the rates of infection as well.
You said earlier that COVID, and I indicated this as well, is a pervasive disease affecting every aspect of our lives, and that's certainly true. And this means that it's a highly interdisciplinary problem with roots in longstanding issues that we're grappling with, like the environment, climate change, food insecurity, social, economic disparities. So how does COVID-19 intersect with these areas? And how does the intersection impact on our mental health?
That's a great question, and I think I'm hoping we can address that in some of the future sessions. We'll need it. There's a lot there to unpack, so to speak. As you kind of alluded to, directly related to this, of course, is some of the existing disparities that we've seen for a long time. So ethnic minorities, especially those low in socioeconomic status, low income, for example, and those people also tend to be essential workers, right? And also people who are exposed more, right? And less access to testing and healthcare, for example. These are also people who are more likely to be experiencing the chronic effects of racism and classism. And the research shows that these things do get under the skin in very real ways to affect our health. So I think early on in this pandemic, you know, the virus was considered the great equalizer and that we're somehow all in the same boat. But it's proving to be quite the opposite, actually. And we're not in the same boat. maybe we could say, some people have used the metaphor that we're in the same ocean, but very different boats. And some of those boats are more seaworthy than others, if you will. Some float very well, some were sinking already before COVID. And so with COVID, some people are really extremely challenged. So, you know, there is a report out just on Monday from The Lancet, which is a leading medical journal, and a survey in July. A large number of respondents in the U.S., medical patients actually, and they're finding that the highest rates of COVID infection based on blood testing are those in the predominantly Black and Hispanic neighborhoods, and the rates are 2 to 3 times higher than the white populations. And that's a significant disparity that we knew that folks in those groups were becoming sick more and more at risk. But the data was, you know, somewhat biased based on how you get that type of data. And this is a little more of a even sampling approach that they took. And also poorer areas, regardless of race, 2 times as high. And if we look at the most densely populated areas, the rates are 10 times higher compared to people who live in more rural areas. So right there, we're seeing the disparities in terms of the actual infections of the virus. And I expect that we're going to see that following suit with stress-related effects. And, you know, we do have a little bit of data supporting that these groups, these different ethnic groups, are really disproportionately affected.
Do we have a sense why? Does the data tell us the reason why a higher percentage of African Americans and Hispanics are infected?
Well, the data aren't telling a complete story, but we know for all the same reasons that these groups have been disproportionately impacted by, you know, chronic conditions are probably very similar. So poor access to healthcare, for example, lack of resources in general. But with COVID, you have those pre-existing health conditions that are more common because of those longstanding health disparities. So those really translate into greater risk of severe infection. But infection in the first place is also a concern. These populations tend to live in communities that are much more densely populated, so urban centers, for example, but also multi-generational households where viruses can be transmitted much more easily. And so they're really getting it kind of in different angles, both in the infection side of things and the severe outcomes of infection when they do get it. Now, I will translate that to mental health. We do have a little data on that. You know, the Hispanic communities have increased COVID-19 trauma-related symptoms more than any other group. And that's true for the Black communities as well. But both groups have high rates of new substance use as well as serious thoughts of suicide. So these health, physical health issues are starting to show up in mental health issues. In some ways, they always have shown up in mental health issues, and also in some ways, these are new ways they're showing up in terms of dramatic increases in suicidal thoughts and substance use.
We've talked a lot about stress, and you've identified the meaning of stress a little bit, but I'd like to go back to that with just the few minutes that we have left, if you would. Stress appears to me to be, to some degree, a catch-all in the data that I read, the studies that I read at any rate. Could you say something about you did a little bit, anger and frustration and so forth that comes out of it, but could you say a little bit more about the nature of stress? Give us some content to this term stress.
Yeah, that's great. And I'm reminded that there's often the saying that Eskimos have many words for snow. And I think, you know,
that's right.
And we certainly have a lot of different ways that we understand stress. And partly because, you know, we define it in different ways. People experience it differently. Sometimes, you know, it's an emotional experience, but stress is different from anxiety, generally speaking, even though they're related, where anxiety is usually a vague sense of uneasiness or worry or danger, a sense of danger maybe. Stress tends to be much more specific. And so even though it's more specific, it still can accumulate to be a very general burden on somebody and accumulate, especially over time. So this can affect our functioning, and sometimes that's how it shows up first, that you're noticing, or other people maybe notice first, that you're not able to do things as well, or you're having trouble sleeping. But oftentimes it's, you know, a subjective sense that you're overburdened, and usually there's a kind of a specific place you can point your finger to it. And let me give you an example. That same American Psychological Association survey is finding that stress among parents of children compared to adults without children are really experiencing more stress. And these are about specific things, about education, meeting basic needs like, you know, food, access to healthcare, things like that. And that's the first real significant increase since 2007 in the context here of COVID-19. So these are very specific concerns that people have. It isn't just a diffuse anxiety, but real kind of concrete areas of stress. And I'll note that locally here, the Life Crisis Center, unofficial statistics here, just in September, have noted that child abuse calls have really been skyrocketing. And so there's definitely these specific sources of stress that people have. And, you know, along with that, other than, you know, parents being stressed, most people, 7 in 10 people in the U.S. are saying the economy is a significant source of stress. And that we haven't seen that since 2008 in the recession. So we're also finding, you know, people of color reporting more significant stress related to COVID-19. And that seems to be related to fear of getting coronavirus and getting basic needs met like food and, you know, employment, as well as access to healthcare. So when we're talking about stress, yeah, it can refer to a lot of things, but in this environment, we certainly have a lot of very specific issues that people are feeling real stress about.
It comes to me as the whole, how it impacts on our normal functioning capacity, as I mentioned earlier, both mentally and physically, that it can become debilitating to us and in our normal functioning. Dr. Mayer, thank you very much for joining me today to talk about this critically important issue, and I'm looking forward to our next discussion as well. And I think that the talk today was very, very enlightening and very, very beneficial to our audience.
Please. If I could, to benefit the audience, we're talking about a lot about crisis and mental health. You know, the Life Crisis Center is kind of equipped to deal with all kinds of different crises, from domestic violence, which we do see some increase with COVID-19, as well as issues of abuse. They can be reached by dialing 211 as a quick way to do that, but also for general mental health concerns. Most county health departments are set up to provide referrals for people, as well as the Life Crisis Center. So folks should have those resources available for themselves or their loved ones.
Carl, thank you very much again.
You're very welcome.
And I want to thank all of you for listening. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.